Who is Beryl Markham?
Beryl Markham is a historical figure best known for flying the Atlantic nonstop and solo east to west in 1936, which makes her a contemporary of Amelia Earhart. But she sort of disappeared from history and is not very well remembered.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western U.S. Our funding comes from public radio members, podcast subscribers, and Humanities Montana. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Paula McLean about her novel, Circling the Sun. Beryl grew up on a farm in Africa in the early 1900s, mostly without a mother. How did she get there and what happened to her mother?
So she was born in 1902 in England, and when she was a toddler in 1904, her father basically had a scheme to move to colonial Kenya, which wasn't even colonial Kenya, it was the British East African Protectorate, where you could buy lots and lots of land for almost no money at all. And he started a horse farm there, sort of bought 1,500 acres of untouched Africa. And that's where she grew up, in this place right up against the Mau Forest, where leopards would come out at night and eat their dogs. Very lawless frontier. And to me, that was really thrilling when I first discovered Beryl, to think about how the place itself both shaped her and also called a wildness out of her. That's something I'm super drawn to, that inner wildness up against the outer wildness of Africa. I wanted to know more about both about her and her life, but also about the place, you know, colonial Africa. I'd always been in love with Out of Africa, the film, and had all sorts of fantasies, you know, being dressed in Ralph Lauren and
out on the savannah
and having Robert Redford wash my hair, because I'd seen that movie like 400 times. It was really easy for me to fall into that world and to want to inhabit it.
From a romantic point of view, wonderful, but Beryl's mother didn't like it so much. She only lasted a couple of years, didn't she?
Yes, exactly. So her father buys this property and starts a horse farm, and about 2 years into that project, her mother gets fed up with Africa, with the wildness, with the difficulty, with having to schlep water for miles, with not having any company or society, and she leaves and takes Beryl's older brother and returns to England and doesn't come back for 16 years.
And Beryl was 4 years old.
Mm.
So she's there on her father's horse farm. She's learning about horses. She's learning about the land. She doesn't have any siblings, so she goes off and finds herself some kids.
Yeah, sort of the native kids on her father's property, members of the Kipsigis tribe, and her best friend is a Kipsigis boy named Kibby. And that's historical. That's actually true. She writes about Kibby in her own memoir, which is called West with the Night, which was first published in 1942. And that was fascinating for me, too, to learn about this friendship between this white girl who's really more of a warrior in training, simply because her mother picks up and leaves and her father is distracted. And it's essentially benign neglect. He lets her run wild. And that is the making of her woman, this woman that I know as supremely unconventional. And that was part of the project of the book, too, for me, after I found Beryl in her own memoir, West with the Night, to figure out how she got to be such a bold, original, fearless woman who would take on something like flying the Atlantic solo.
And I want to remind people who are listening that we're talking about a novel. You have taken a real person and written a novel in her voice.
Yes.
And for anybody who's not a writer, writing in first person is very confining. And so you've confined yourself to the first person voice.
Yes.
And then you've also confined yourself to...
to historical period and all those facts
right.
on record. And yeah, it's a challenge that I like. And I've done it before. So the first historical novel that I did was called The Paris Wife. And it was about Ernest Hemingway's first marriage to Hadley Richardson and their time in Paris in the 1920s when they were sort of part of a golden circle of expats, including F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda and Gertrude Stein and
wonderful
Ezra Pound.
Book. Very wonderful book.
Thank you. But I kind of stumbled onto that as an idea. It never occurred to me to write historical fiction until I happened upon Hemingway's memoir, A Movable Feast, and became fascinated by that part of his life and by this relationship and how romantic it was and how tragic a love story it was. And so she became my vehicle for entering the story. And the fact that I found her voice, that I started to write that book from the first person, was never a rational decision. You know, she was my ticket to 1920s Paris to get close to him and that whole circle. And I never really thought about what I was doing. Some people have said I've invented a genre of whatever you would call it, fictional memoir or biographical fiction. I didn't invent anything, but I think it is that idea of choosing to write from the first person about a real life historical figure. Maybe that's what they're talking about.
Well, you had to be somewhat embodied writing as if this were actually your memoir. And your first book was a memoir. And your second book was memoir-ish, even though it was...
I think you've hit on something. It probably is my sweet spot as a writer to write in a very immersed way. And also in a very voice-driven way. So when I happened upon this idea to write, essentially to write A Movable Feast from Hadley Richardson's point of view, her voice, that was the secret sauce. That was the whole ball of wax. Once it occurred to me that to write this book from her point of view, her voice was everything. Getting her voice was, that was the magic.
And it was the magic, because when I read that book, I thought, the voice is so clear and so strong and so authentic. That's what makes the book remarkable.
Thank you. I think of it as sort of more of an actor's trick,
mm-hmm.
getting into the skull of a character and looking through their eyes, their vantage point, their point of view is essentially how I read as a kid, too. I wanted to disappear. I wanted all those boundaries to blur and to fall into a world and not wake up at all. And so that's what I like as a writer. I want a completely immersive experience. I had never been to Paris when I took on this idea. I had never been to Africa when I decided to write about Africa. And so that's part of what I love, is getting completely lost in my research until I disappear into this world. Writing from a first person, too, I think allows me to descend more completely into a character.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Because you're not looking at the story from the outside mm-hmm. in.
I don't want to be objective.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even want to try to be objective. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I want to believe for the time that I'm writing the book that I'm Beryl Markham. I don't want those barriers to knowledge or experience. I want to get to the bottom of her.
Although I knew nothing about Beryl before I started reading the book, I felt like you created a pretty authentic voice for some wild child who grew up without restrictions.
Yeah.
And I really, really liked the part of the book where Mrs. Orchardson comes to live with her and her father.
A woman who's basically been brought on board to tame young Beryl when she's been running around completely lawlessly, you know, hunting warthog in the bush barefoot with spears, essentially.
And so Mrs. Orchardson comes into the house, and I'd like you to read the scene where Beryl reacts to Mrs. Orchardson and her new restrictions.
Sure, I'd be delighted. Within a week, she'd convinced my father that I needed to wear shoes. A few weeks more, and I'd been trussed up in an English frock and hair ribbons instead of a shuka, and told not to eat with my hands. I was not to kill snakes or moles or birds with my rungu club, or to take all my meals with Kibby and his family. I was not to hunt warthog or leopard with Arap Mena, but to have a proper education and learn the king's English. "I've let you run too wild, and you know it," my father said when I went to him asking to be left alone. "It's all for your own good." He had let me run, but it had been wonderful. These new restrictions amounted to a conventional life, and we'd never had anything of the sort. "Please," I heard myself begin to whine, and then stopped short. I had never been a wheedling or complaining child, and my father wasn't going to bend anyway. If I really could do something about Mrs. Orchardson, I would have to work it out on my own. I would show her I wasn't a bit of a cobweb in the corner, something to be wiped out or straightened, but a rival worth her notice. I would learn her ways and habits and track her closely until I knew what she was and how to best her and what precisely it would take to steal my good life back. Isn't she awesome?
She is. I'm going to track her.
Yes, I'm going to track her. Yeah.
After she grew up, she was part of a group of people that included Karen Blixen and Dennis
Finchatten.
Yes. And those are the characters from Out of Africa.
Yeah. So Karen Blixen wrote Out of Africa under the pen name Isaac Denson. And Dennis Finchatten is the safari hunter who was immortalized in both the book Out of Africa and in the film adaptation starring Meryl Streep and Robert Redford.
If Beryl was there and she wasn't included in Out of Africa, did you make up the part about her being in that gang?
No. No, in fact, Karen Blixen wrote her out of Out of Africa because Beryl was her rival. I mean, there's no paper trail to support that. There is simply the evidence of Beryl not being in the book. But, you know, so too is Karen Blixen not in Beryl's book, West with the Night. So Karen never shows up in Beryl's book, and Beryl never shows up in Karen's book. It seems to me that that's enough of a smoking gun. To me, Karen Blixen is one of the most fascinating women from history, and the fact that I get to hang out with both of these women. And those scenes, the scenes between Karen and Beryl, were my favorites to write. And of course, I became as obsessed with Karen Blixen's life as I did with Beryl's life. And Beryl was not a great letter writer, but Karen Blixen wrote her mother every Sunday for decades. So I had a lot of material. And in fact, that's how I knew Beryl was very much a part of her life, is because she shows up in all those letters, but she doesn't show up in the in the book. See? Mm. Isn't that fascinating?
Yes.
But they were both women ahead of their time. They were both women who struggled with independence and being overly independent, with not quite fitting. They weren't conventional women at all. When Karen's marriage to Bror Blixen sort of dissolves, she takes Dennis Finchatten as a lover. Well, that just simply didn't happen, that would be a publicly known thing, that she's living with him out of wedlock. I mean, it's, you know, it's still 1920-something.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, and I'm talking with Paula MacLean about her latest novel, Circling the Sun. She's also the author of The Paris Wife. You can contribute financial support for The Right Question at mtpr.org. That's also the place where you can listen to this program again or share it with a friend and find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages. mtpr.org is the place to find all of that. Coming up, the consequences of Teddy Roosevelt's African invasion, and Paula McLean will read another short passage from the book. In your story, Dennis blames Teddy Roosevelt for some of the problems in Africa during the 1920s. Explain why.
Dennis Van Chatten, believe it or not, was one of the earliest ecologists and conservationists. He loved the wildness of Africa. He was a safari hunter, so obviously a very skilled hunter. But he was really one of the first people who suggested that we might try photographic safaris instead of actually shooting the animals. He was afraid that the country would be ruined, and he was afraid of decimating the wildlife population. The reason he blames Teddy Roosevelt is because Teddy Roosevelt went on safari quite famously for the Smithsonian and ended up, you know, shooting some 500 animals and being photographed sort of sitting atop wildebeests and elephants and sort of making it look incredibly glamorous. So then safari hunting became a sport and a pastime, and it wasn't done well. It was done quite badly, in fact, and for trophies.
Mm-hmm. So somebody could put an animal head on their wall.
Or a rug in their house and mm-hmm. boast.
Well, there were all kinds of ways in which animals were not being allowed to be themselves. And one was a scene where there was a pet lion living on the property of friends of Beryl and her father. And in the scene, I think Beryl is 12 years old. And I'd just like you to read the passage about the lion from that chapter.
Sure. This, by the way, is a moment that Beryl also addresses in her memoir, West with the Night, this encounter with Patty the lion. Yeah, so Beryl and her father are on a day ride out to a neighboring farm, the Elkington's farm, where they're keeping this lion as a pet. "That damned animal makes me nervous," my father said. "I don't mind telling you, it's unnatural for a wild creature to be kept like that." "I like Patty," I said, remembering how I had once seen Jim Elkington rub him like a cat. "He's a good lion." "Which only proves my point," my father said, while behind us, the groom, Bishan Singh, clucked his agreement. "You can take a cub from the savannah, as they have, and raise it like a pet if you like, in a cage, as some do, or running free, like Patty. You can feed it fresh meat so it never learns to hunt, and brush its coat so it carries a human smell wherever it goes. But know that what you've done is twist something natural into something else. And you can never trust an unnatural thing. You don't know what it is, and it's baffled too, poor damned animal," he said again, and blew air upward toward his nose to clear away some of the dust. The Elkington's house had lead glass windows and a pretty veranda that backed onto absolute wilderness, 1,000 miles or more of untamed Africa. And there was a feeling as you sat and ate your nice sandwich or had your tea that you were on the slowly tipping edge of nothingness and might fall forward at any moment, and that if you did, it was possible that nothing would know you had ever been there at all. Jim Elkington was round and red-faced and even-tempered. His wife wore a straw boater and white blouses she kept crisp and civilized-looking somehow, even with a rawhide whip tucked into her belt. The whip was for Patty, who roamed about the property as if he owned it, and in the clearest sort of way he did. Who would challenge him, after all? He had been like a puppy once, thick-pawed, wrestling Jim on the lawn, but now he was full-grown, his ruff of mane black-tipped and glossy. The whip was only a prop. The last time I had seen Patty, Jim Elkington had fed him a string of skinned rabbits on a pike as we watched. The lion rested flat with his paws crossed, full-shouldered and rust-colored with black lips and jowls. He had enormous golden eyes and seemed aware of the picture he made as he let the dainties come to him. There was a wrinkled place above his perfectly square nose which made him look puzzled or even a little amused by us. As we settled our horses, I didn't see Paddy, but I could hear him off somewhere, maybe miles away, roaring. It was a tortured sound and also a little mournful, stiffening the fine hairs on the back of my neck. "He sounds lonely," I said. "Rot," my father said, "more like a howling banshee." "I don't hear it anymore," Mrs. Elkington said, and then led us to her tea. The veranda was airless that day, and the conversation stultifying. I sighed and picked at a second ginger cake until my father finally gave me a look and a nod. "Go on, then." I went out into the open country running fast, just to feel myself do it. Their land was much like ours, with dry grasses, dusty green and gold, and the rolling plains studded with thorn and flame trees, or sometimes a single fat baobab. Away in the distance, I could see the cloud-softened crags of Mount Kenya and thought of how wonderful it would be to run there 100 miles away. Ahead of me, there was a low hill with gooseberry bushes on top. I made a beeline for them, only half noticing a place in the grass where something large had slept recently, crushing the stems all around into a curved, pressed-down mold. I had my eyes on the hill, and I didn't think of anything else or know that I was being watched as I ran, stalked from behind like a young gazelle or Kongani. I picked up speed, scrambling over the rise, and that's when I felt a force of air push at me, hot and meaty. The blow was like a steel pipe aimed at the muscles of my back. I went down hard, face first in the grass, my arms coming up instinctively to protect myself. I didn't know how long Paddy had been watching me. He had smelled me first, possibly before I had left the veranda. Maybe he had only been curious about my girl smell, or maybe he had started hunting me even then. It didn't really matter, because he had already overpowered me. Paddy's jaw closed on my thigh above the knee. I felt his dagger teeth and his wet tongue, the strangely cool feel of his mouth. My head swam as I smelled my own blood, and then he released me to bellow. It was everything I had heard from the veranda and more, a vibrating black cave of noise that swallowed the earth and sky and swallowed me too. I closed my eyes and tried to scream, but only released a puff of air. I felt Paddy's mouth again and knew I had no chance at all. He would eat me here or drag me off to a glade or a valley only he knew of, a place from which I would never return. And the last thought I remember having was, "This is how it feels then. This is what it means to be eaten by a lion."
Yikes.
Yeah. It's fairly intense. You know, in Beryl's own rendering of that account, what's most striking is her identification with Paddy the lion and her sympathy for him. That's really the point of her telling the story, is how, in fact, it's all the human's fault that Paddy would be attacking her. It's her fault for running in front of him. It's her fault for tempting him, mm-hmm. you know? And in fact, she felt quite guilty when he was later captured.
She was somebody who was raised around animals, mm-hmm. who knew their tracks, who knew their habits. So I can see why she would think that way.
Yeah, I think it also is kind of a psychologically interesting moment for me, how Beryl identifies herself more as a wild creature, much more like Paddy than Mrs. Orchardson, for mm-hmm. instance. Later in the novel, there's an encounter with a wild, even a murderous racehorse that has killed a groom that Beryl takes on as a pet project, as a love project, passion project, because she believes this animal has been wronged somehow and needs a second chance.
That might have been deep in her psyche, because she was something of a wild animal herself, yeah. and was wronged. Her mother left her. And
yes, and people tried to tame her, mm-hmm. and she wouldn't be held in a box. I think it's too, you know, why she's never very good at marriage. She grows up in this way that forges her, and she doesn't know how to be submissive. She doesn't know how to take orders from a husband. She doesn't really know how to be in a box as a housewife. She fails at it, sort of Completely. But then we're sort of rooting for her, though, to figure out the fact that she's not meant to be domestic, that it's unnatural, in fact, that she would try.
She learns how to fly, and the last we see of her is in 1936 when she is heading out across the Atlantic Ocean in the dark in a storm.
And 2,000 feet above the pitching waves. Yeah, no radio contact.
Yeah, a person who had grown up in a normal household probably wouldn't do that.
No, and I think that's what I meant when I said, you know, I encountered Beryl in her own book, but we don't, her book is such an impersonal view of her life. She tells us about her daring adventures, the flying across the Atlantic, her career as a racehorse trainer in Kenya. So she gives us her great stories, but we don't know how she became that person. So then that was my task, really, to sort of discover her, to put together all those pieces. So I would just take a moment from her biography that Mrs. Orchardson came and tried to tame her, and then I would dramatize that. I would build scenes pointing to this idea of the arc of her life, how she goes from being this wild creature at the beginning, and basically every bad decision she makes in the book and in her life comes from losing her way and forgetting who she actually is at bottom.
What do you think Beryl would think of this book?
She would hate it. She would hate it because she was such a private person. You know, West with the Night is not personal for very specific reasons. She was a cagey, sphinx-like person in her life. It was very difficult to get close to Beryl. Her friends sort of testify to this. She was a closed system, not interested in dishing the dirt on her own life. Hemingway, too, when I read A Movable Feast, that was what was most evident to me and probably what really generated my obsession with trying to get to the bottom. What was he leaving out in A Movable Feast? That was all the stuff that I wanted to know as a curious person. What happened? You know, what happened to these two young lovers so that they had to lose each other? And in this case, you know, how did the universe make a Beryl Markham?
Who's up in your radar screen next?
Well, I can tell you, because it's been publicized, I have some unfinished business with my friend Ernest Hemingway, and my subject is actually his third wife, war correspondent Martha Gellhorn, who is fascinating. They can't live with each other, and they can't live without each other. It's a stormy love relationship.
I'll look forward to that one.
Thank you.
Paula McLean is the author of four books, including The Paris Wife and Circling the Sun. Look for more information about her and sign up for our podcast at mtpr.org. Also, there are children's book reviews, poetry, and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting The Right Question since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. Please consider making a financial contribution of your own. Again, we're online at mtpr.org. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you piles of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.